Okay, so in Luke chapter 16, Jesus tells us about the parable of the shrewd manager. Now, I'm going to be honest, it's not the snappiest parable, so what I'm going to do is just skip straight to the point. Essentially, there's two ways that we can treat our money. Now, the first one is that we hoard it to ourselves, we keep it to ourselves. And as you can see, what we've very cleverly done here is it's quite arty and abstract, but we've used chocolate coins to represent money. And see, young Matthew here, yeah, he's kept it all to himself, and Nigel's very sad because he didn't get to share in the chocolatey goodness. And actually, Matt's feeling a little bit unwell there, and he thinks that's a great idea. Well, that was wrong, Matthew. That was very naughty. Don't do that. Let's have another go at this. Of course, the other option that we take what we have, our money, our material possessions, and we share it out in generosity and in love, and we use it to further God's kingdom. Jesus leaves us with this. He says, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
My name is Matt, there we are. I'm part of the team here, and we're continuing our series, Change Your Story, tonight. Philip kicked us off last week, and we're looking at three different stories that Jesus told, which tell us things about life that really affect the way that we live our lives, the direction our lives go in, and the stories that we're writing for ourselves. Because here's something that you already know, this is obvious, we all know this, but if you want to change the results that you see in your life, you have to change your behavior. It'd be foolish to just do the same thing over and over again and expect that somehow it's going to turn out differently. We all know that. And if you want to change your behavior, well, a good starting place is to change your story. Because you're writing a story with your life. With every decision that you make, you're writing a story. And so tonight, as you've seen, we're going to be talking about money, because money is one of the key areas in our lives that we have decision-making power. And we don't talk about money very much at church, but when we do, we want to be really clear what we believe the Bible has to say about it, what our responsibilities are. So we only do this about two or maybe three times a year, and we're going to do it tonight. Because money is one of the big ways that you can really tell a story and impact the direction of your life, who you are, and what the world perceives of you. If I were to get up your bank statement on one of these screens right now, how would you feel? What kind of story would it tell us? Some of you are pretty uncomfortable by just the thought of that. Would it tell us a story of a savvy saver, someone who's already got a few months' worth of income sitting in a savings account so that whatever happens, they know they're going to be okay. They're going to be able to kind of weather the storms. Or would it tell a story of someone who's actually just about managing to survive between paychecks, occasionally dipping into their overdraft to get them through? Things get a bit tight towards the end of the month, but they're managing to stay afloat. What if I could only see the money that you're spending and not the money that was coming in? If I only knew how you were using your money and not how much money you had, what sort of story would that tell? Would I think, based on your expenditure, that you are some kind of high-flying stock trader, when actually, the truth is you're a student who's going to be living on Alphabetti spaghetti for the rest of the year? Or would I think that you're someone who's on the poverty line and is struggling, when actually you've got a healthy income, you've got enough to survive, but you're gripped with fear and you don't like the uncertainty in the future, and so you don't want to spend your money in the here and now, so you'd hoard it for that rainy day that never quite comes, but you never feel good about money? We all tell a story with our money. For some of you, it's a horror story. If the person sitting next to you has broken out in a cold sweat in the last couple of minutes, theirs is probably a crime thriller or something like that, and they're thinking, I'm onto them, and they're really hoping that I don't pull up their bank statement on the screens. I did go through a few people's bins, but they're not very interesting. So, yeah. Anyway, you tell a story with your money. And money is an emotive subject. It really is. For some people, you talk about money, we think about money, and there's this knot in your stomach. There's a sense of fear and anxiety. You're really uncomfortable about money. You don't feel like you're very good at it, or you just don't feel like you've got any of it to have the freedom to do anything with. Some people sitting here, actually, your history with money gives you a sense of guilt or shame. You're not happy with some of the decisions that you've made before. And so, whatever boat you're in, we should want to know what Jesus has to say about money. Because Jesus, we believe, is the Prince of Peace. And so if money is a nervous subject for you, if it's something that makes you uncomfortable, I just want to encourage you to lean into this. Lean into what the Bible has to say about money. Because before anything else, it should bring us peace and freedom as a kind of a playing field to operate from. And so we're going to look at a story that Jesus told. But first, some of you, I also want to say, you're feeling skeptical. When someone gets up in church and starts talking about money, you are immediately suspicious because all your life you've just heard people trying to raise money to fix the leaking roof or to polish the bells or that kind of thing. And then maybe you saw earlier this year, there was this big Instagram account that kind of went viral in certain circles called Preachers with Sneakers. And it was all these different preachers around the world who were preaching whilst showing off their collection of kind of trainers, which in some cases ran to like tens of thousands of dollars. And you think, if you're giving your money to the church, they're just spending it on footwear, and that's probably not ideal. That's not what you want to be happening when you're giving your money to the church. And I've never spent any of the church's money on footwear, so I am qualified to make this preach, I hope. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So as we saw, don't draw attention to my shoes, they're plain, it's fine. As we saw, there's this story that Jesus told about a rich man and his financial manager. It starts like this. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer. We've got this guy who's getting fired because he's been on a massive bender with this rich guy's money. It was his job to look after it, to manage his contracts. This is a businessman. He's got a lot of clients, a lot of people that he's doing trade with. And this money manager works for him and has all that responsibility. But the rich man has heard bad things, and he calls him in and he sacks him. When he says, give an account of your management, what he's saying is, give me the account books back. Because as long as he had the account books, he had the rich man's legal authority to do business on his behalf. And so the story continues that the manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. He is looking at his future, and he's not liking it. Because he's fairly well off. He's in a pretty comfortable position in society, being the financial manager for a rich guy. He's well looked after. He's got good responsibility, because you need to look after your financial manager. Otherwise, they're just going to take advantage of you. Or in this case, that didn't avoid that happening. And he's looking and he's thinking, if I get fired, no one else is ever going to employ me as a financial manager, because I won't have a reference. Everyone's going to know that guy kicked me out. And so my options are manual labor or begging, and those were the bottom of the barrel as far as he was concerned. So he's looking at his situation, he's looking at his story, and he thinks something needs to change. So he comes up with a plan. He says, I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, And how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. So what's happening here is the rich guy has made a crucial error. Now, some of you are managers of people. Some of you in future will be managers of people. Here's a bit of advice for when you ever have to sack someone. You don't sack the chef until they're out of the kitchen. You don't sack the social media guru until you've changed the Twitter password. These things backfire. You definitely don't sack your financial manager until you've got the account books and the big rubber stamp that says approved back in your possession. And this rich man made that mistake. He hadn't got that back. And so as far as the law was concerned, the financial manager still had the power to do business on the rich man's behalf. And he takes advantage of this. He calls in these debtors, and the kind of amounts that we're talking about here, all these bushels of wheat and olive oil, this is a lot of resources. These are kind of big contracts. And so the debtors themselves are quite well-off people. And they live in this honor-bound society. So the manager knows that if he does a favor with this little bit of opportunity he's got for some other well-off people, when he's out of his job, they will be honor-bound to look after him, to take him into their houses, and he'll basically become a professional house guest, and he'll just move around, people will look after him, and it'll all be good. Much better than having to like dig or beg or something like that. So that's what he's doing. He's giving people these big discounts to earn favor with them. And then the story goes on, and a really weird thing happens. It says, the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. This guy has just been sacked, and he's cheated the rich man out of more money, and the rich man finds out, and he says, yeah, fair play, that was pretty clever. It's kind of like, you sort of think that that's a weird reaction, but I don't know, it's maybe like a mafia film where everyone's kind of scoring points against each other, and really it's all part of this game. So you have to admire the opposition when they manage to pull one over on you. And that's what happens here. The rich guy says, okay, yeah, that was pretty clever. He's been backed into a corner. The manager knew that there was no way that he could undo these contracts that he'd signed, the discounts that he's made. Otherwise, the honor agreement wouldn't hold any water. He'd just undo it, and the manager would still be in the same situation. But he's seen the reality, he saw his opportunity, and he's used it. And then it gets even weirder, because Jesus starts talking and kind of giving his view on this story, his commentary. And he says, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Jesus is pointing to this guy who has lied and cheated and got sacked and lied and cheated again after that. And he says, be more like him. What? Like, Jesus, this is not a good story. That is not someone you want to put on a pedestal and point to as a role model. You know, has he never heard of Mother Teresa? I mean, anyway, so Jesus points to this guy and says you should be more like him. Well, what does he mean? Because surely Jesus isn't commending the lying and the cheating. And when we come across something a bit weird in our Bibles like this, it's fine. We just need to stop, take a deep breath, think about it in the light of everything else we already know. Maybe read some books written by some people who know more than us. That's what I did to write this talk. I just sat in the library and read some good books. And we put the pieces together. And we know that the rest of the Bible is really pretty clear that lying and cheating are wrong. So Jesus isn't saying anything new about that. So what we can rule out is Jesus is not commending the behavior itself. That's bad. Lying, cheating, still bad, okay? Okay, Matt Miles is on board. This is good, yeah. The rest of what we can learn from this, though, is that actually it's the attitude to opportunity that Jesus is commending. When he says that the children of this world are more shrewd, he's talking about the non-believers, people who don't have this kind of view that there is a better life to come throughout eternity, that they're going to inherit this great promise. It's someone who just thinks, this life is all I've got. And people who think like that are pretty good at knowing that they need to make their own fortune. This is it. This opportunity, this story is the whole thing. It's fine that they write a story that's all about me, myself, and I. Because they're the central character as far as they're concerned. And so people who think like that are good at taking opportunities when they arise. But for some reason, Jesus says that the children of the light, that's people who are believers, people who believe in God, believe in a God who provides, believe that there's this great life to come, they're not so good at taking opportunities. And Jesus doesn't really tell us why, but I think maybe it's complacency. It's this thought that, well, I know that I've got this great inheritance that's coming one day, so I kind of don't need to worry too much in the present. Things might not be great. Someone might have a bit more money than me, but that's okay. And they just start to treat the opportunities that they've got and the possessions that they have and the money that they get as kind of pocket money or toys just to fill the time until they get the full inheritance. And Jesus says that they are missing something. Jesus says that that's not good enough and that these bad people that he's pointing to, actually there's something you can learn from them. Their behavior's not good, but at least they take the opportunities that come along. At least they're not just on autopilot, handling their money and their possessions and the chances that they get in a way that, you know, they're half asleep all the time. And Jesus sheds more light on this. He says, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? There's two things that I think Jesus is saying here that I want to point out for you. The first is this comparison between worldly wealth and true riches. Jesus is saying that however much money you have got now, if you were to multiply that by the biggest number you could possibly think of, that still wouldn't be true riches. No amount of money or possessions in this world is true riches. We don't yet have true riches. But he's saying if you can prove yourself trustworthy, one day you will have true riches. That is something that is on the table for you, but it's just not here now. What you've got now is worldly wealth. It doesn't matter whether the person sitting next to you has more worldly wealth than you. You have got some worldly wealth. In fact, if you are in Bristol, if you live here, you're a student, or you've got a job here, then as Philip said last week, you are one of the most wealthy people in the world. Even if there are other people in this room who are more wealthy than you, you have got quite a lot of worldly wealth by comparison to other people. And there's a direction between what he says. He says at the moment, you've got worldly wealth, and eventually you'll have true riches. But what he says in parallel to this is even more important. And for some of you, you'll know this. You'll already know this. For others, this is going to be a bit of an uncomfortable realization. You've not thought about this before, or you might have heard people talk about it, but you've not quite seen it in your Bible, so you've kind of been able to ignore it until now. But the other thing he talks about is someone else's property and property of your own. And just like we don't yet have true riches, but we do have worldly wealth, the implications of what Jesus is saying is that there's a direction here as well, and that you don't yet have property of your own, but at the moment you do have someone else's property. And that's a pretty big shake-up of the way that we like to think about our stuff and our bank balance. We like to think it's mine. When I get my payslip, it has my name on it. That's my stuff. But Jesus is actually saying something quite different. Jesus is saying no matter how much or how little you've got at the moment, it's not really yours. That is someone else's property. Whose property is it? Well, it's God's. Every penny that you've got is ultimately the wealth of God that he has trusted to you. In fact, here's something that's true about you that maybe you didn't know. You are a money manager. Put that on a business card if you like. You are a money manager for God. He has trusted you with all the resources that you have and all the resources you'll ever have for the rest of your life. But there's another thing. You're a money manager with a limited time opportunity. Just like the money manager in the story that Jesus told, you've got a limited time opportunity. You can look to the future and you can do things in your present that change the story that is going to be told. And whilst the man in the story behaves in a way that changes it and keeps it centered around him, it makes things better for him, it's a self-centered story, that's not the kind of opportunity that Jesus wants us to take. But we do have an opportunity to change our story. We have an opportunity now to change our story of the city, of your friends, of your family. You have the opportunity to change the story of the people that you work with, the people that live in your block of flats. All these stories that we're interacting with and that we're part of, those are the opportunities that Jesus wants us to take. And we've got to do some family business tonight. So if you are here and you're a follower of Jesus and you're a member of this church, the next 10 minutes or so are pretty important. We're going to be pretty clear about some things that we think. And it doesn't matter whether you have a regular income, you've got a job, you get a paycheck every month, or whether you're a student, or whether you are a full-time parent, or you're not able to work at the moment. The fact is you've got resources to play with. You've got resources that you've been trusted with by God. You're a manager of those resources. And there are implications of that. You've got decisions to make about that. Now, if you're here and you're part of the church or you're visiting and you're not a follower of Jesus, you can sit back. You can breathe a sigh of relief. We're not expecting a penny from you. We're not after your money. We're not going to come around and pinch from your wallet when you go up for tea and coffee at the end. You can chill out. But it's just kind of like, you know, sometimes you go to like a friend's house and their parents start having a really awkward conversation while you're at the dinner table with them. And you're like, oh, could you not just talk about this some other time when I've gone? It's kind of going to feel a little bit like that. But there's a reason for that. We want to be completely transparent. We want you to know the stuff that we're telling other people. We want you to know what our attitude as a church is towards money, because you deserve to know. And so, here's the thing. Let me be really honest with you. As a church, Metro needs to change its story. We need to change our story as a community, because we are a loss-making church. That's the simple fact of the matter. It costs more money for us to do this than we get in from people who are part of the church giving towards that. And you know, that's been okay for a while. We've been, the way that it works, the way we can do this, is because we're subsidized by money that comes in from people who give to the wider Woodlands group of churches that we're part of. And that's been fine. You know, I've got a little godson. He's about 20 months old. And if I was around having dinner with kind of him and his parents next week, and they turn to him and they start saying, when are you going to go out and get a job? When are you going to start living on your own money? You're bleeding is dry, and we think you need to start pulling your weight around here. I would have to step in, and I'd have to say, hang on, he's only like 20 months old. He's not even 2 yet. Give it a few years before you send him down the mine. Like, come on. Whereas in like 3 decades' time, if I'm going for dinner with them, and they start turning to him and saying, it's really about time you get a job. I mean, come on. Well, I'm going to be siding with them. Because to start with, they chose to be parents. They chose to become parents, and they knew that it was going to cost them in all sorts of ways. And one of those ways is financially. They knew what they were getting themselves in for. But there comes a time when actually, my godson's going to need to be supporting himself. He's going to have grown up, and he's got a responsibility to look after himself. It's exactly the same when you plant a church. And so a few years ago, when this church was planted, that happened because some people effectively decided to become parents. They decided that they were going to create this new life which was going to cost them. And they knew for a while that was going to involve it being financially as well. But just like my godson has to grow up and has to become self-sufficient, as a church, we need to grow up and we need to become self-sufficient. We can't expect our parents to be supporting us forever, as it were. And in fact, in January, we're going to become parents ourselves. Yeah? It's great. You know, we're going to have a new service. We're going to have new life, and it's going to cost us financially as well. There's going to be more higher costs to pay for the venue. There's going to be more muffins to buy and teas and coffees and things like that. The expenses are going to increase. And to be able to do that, we need to start raising more money. We need to become self-sufficient because we can't keep being subsidized forever. And we've always been really clear that the vision of Metro is to plant churches that plant churches. We want to benefit the whole city. We want to see this city transformed by people who are coming to Jesus through expressions of church that look a bit like this. Churches that people can bring their friends to all around this city. But we can't do that if actually we fall at this first hurdle. If we can't make the books balance for the church the way that we do it, we can't start rolling that out and doing that in other locations and doing that more and more. So we need to change our story. And we need to change our story by raising more money. And we believe that we're doing God's work. We believe that we're doing something that God has called us to do. And we believe that God's going to provide financially for that. You know, I think that God is going to provide. But I don't think God is going to provide with a magic money tree. And I don't think Philip's going to wake up tomorrow and find a beanstalk in his back garden that he needs to climb to go and get a golden goose. God is going to provide, but the way he's going to do it is not with some kind of crazy miracle. It's through a really ordinary miracle. It's a beautiful miracle, but it's really ordinary. And it's the miracle of you guys, your hearts being touched by God's grace and him stirring you to step into a story that isn't all about you when it comes to your finances. It's through you guys who are sitting here, who are part of this church, giving up some of your money for the benefit of the church. That is how God is going to provide. You are his plan to make this church work. And so I want to talk a bit about what it looks like to give to the church. I think this is something, like I've said, that it doesn't really matter if you're a student or if you're working or you're not able to work at the moment. You need to think this stuff through. You need to wrestle with it. I don't have a regular income at the moment, so I work 2 or 3 days a week for the church, but I don't get paid a penny because the church can't afford it. And the rest of the week, I'm a full-time student. So I live at home because that's the only option I have. I couldn't afford to pay rent anywhere else. And I have to make other sacrifices to make this work because this is what I think God has called me to do at the moment. But just because I don't have a regular income, I don't have a salary, I realized I can't ignore this for the next few years. I can't just think, oh, I don't need to give financially to the church because I'm not working in a way that brings in money at the moment. Because the fact is that I do have a lot of resources. I've got a lot of possessions that I already own. I've got a student loan that comes in. I get given money for kind of my birthday and for Christmas and that kind of thing. And so whatever it looks like for you to have money and possessions, there's some things that you need to apply to this. And we've got three principles for giving at Metro that I found really helpful in working out what that needs to look like for me. And I think you'll find really helpful working out what it needs to look like for you. And we take these from one verse that's in the New Testament in our Bibles. And Paul is writing a letter to a young church, a bit like us, and it says this: on the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. And that's exactly what we believe as well. We think that this is relevant advice for us. And the three principles that we pull out of this, the first one is that giving should be proportional. Predetermined. So on the first day, it says, you need to decide what you're going to give in advance. Because if you decide that, oh, I'll see what I've got left at the end of the month, what happens is you don't have much left at the end of the month. And so Paul is saying, at the start of the week or at the start of the month, when that paycheck comes in, that is when you need to make your decisions about giving. In fact, really, you should make your decision before it comes in, and it should just be your first action when you get that money. The next thing is that it's personal. It's the responsibility of everyone in the church. He addresses this to each of you. Everyone needs to think about this, think about their circumstances, and apply this. And thirdly, it's proportional. It should be in keeping with your income. So as your income increases, that means your giving should increase. If you go through a time where your income is decreasing, well, then it's okay for your giving to decrease. And effectively, that looks like choosing a percentage that you're going to give to the church. I don't know how it is that you look at your money at the moment, how you do your budgeting and your finance, but most people will probably, by default, live on 100% of their income. In fact, a lot of the statistics show that the majority of people live on about 110% of their income. People, you know, taking out loans, living in their overdrafts. People max out their lifestyle. And so, have you ever considered something other than living 100% lifestyle? Because I think that is what we as Christians are called to do. We're called to make sacrifice, and we've got to give sacrificially. It's always going to be sacrificial. And so there's a few questions that I want you to really ask yourself tonight, this week, think through, because this is a responsibility of everyone. If God is going to be providing through you, to do the work in this church. The first is, what percentage would I like to give? Everyone should be able to answer this question. What percentage would you like to give of your income to this church? And this is in an ideal world. This is, you know, setting aside your actual circumstances, what would it be? Now, some of you will know, if you've been around church before, that there was this thing in the Old Testament called tithing. And this was a law that applied to the Jews, that they had to give 10% of everything that they earned, all of their crops and their livestock, they had to give towards their religious community. That was part of their law. And a lot of churches keep this as a decent measure of how we as Christians should approach giving. Now, there's also the fact that nowhere in the New Testament, nowhere after Jesus was alive and was teaching, is there a percentage given. And the law was fulfilled, so we're not bound by this 10% law anymore. But there's a lot of other laws that we're not bound by. And the general thrust of things moving from the Old Testament to the New Testament is actually that the stakes are raised. You know, the Old Testament says that you shouldn't sleep with your neighbor's wife. The New Testament says if you even look at your neighbor's wife lustfully, you've committed adultery. The stakes have been raised. Jesus has come onto the scene, and the bar is a lot higher. Similarly, the Old Testament says you shouldn't kill anyone. The New Testament says if you are so much as angry with one of your brothers or sisters, then that is equivalent to killing them. Like, the bar is massively higher. So I want to suggest, and this is the conclusion I've come to personally, and you have to weigh this for yourselves, but I think 10% is still a very good baseline guide for us to work with. And so what would you like to give in an ideal world? Would it be 10%? Would it be more? More is good. I know of some people who decided when they were young that every year of their lives they wanted to increase their giving to the church. Sometimes it would be by 0.5%. Sometimes it would be by a few percent. But they had this story in mind that they wanted to write of generosity and giving towards God's work. That sounds pretty good to me. That's the kind of thing that I would like to say, that's what I want to aim for. I'll also say at this point, honestly, if your answer to this question is what percentage would I like to give, the answer is 0%, this probably isn't the church for you. You know, we love you, but why would you trust us with your spiritual well-being if for some reason you don't trust us with your money? Why would you come here and kind of give your time to this place if you don't think it's worth putting some money towards it to actually make it happen? You know, go somewhere else, go to another church where you trust them or you believe in their vision more to give to them. But if the answer to your like ideal amount of money to give the church is 0%, I don't know why you're here. But come and talk to me afterwards because, you know, I want to love you and we can chat about it. Don't just leave. It's just my little disclaimer so I don't want to get sacked from my non-paying job. Anyway, moving on swiftly. What percentage can I give now? That's the second question. We've set our ideal. We know what we want to aim for. What can I afford to give now? Some of you are already giving, and that's great, but actually the majority of members of this church aren't giving anything to it. It's probably about a 60-40 split. 60% aren't giving anything towards this church. And like I said, I think you need to start. I think that's a responsibility we have as followers of Jesus, as members of this church. It's something that we need to be doing. So where can you start? Some of you, you'll be able to start at 10%, or you'll be able to start at more. For others of you, that just sounds too scary. Maybe your rent is too high. You're too used to living on this kind of 100% lifestyle that suddenly if you cut out 10%, you actually wouldn't be able to make ends meet. So what can you start giving now? And I want to suggest, I really think that every single person in this room If you said that you wanted, in an ideal world, to be giving 10% of your income to the church, I reckon you could achieve that by this time next year. I think that that is something we could all achieve. And the way you do it is next month, you go from living a 100% lifestyle to living a 99% lifestyle. You give 1% to the church as soon as your next paycheck comes in. And you know what? You'll survive. It'll be fine. You might be in the supermarket and you'll be there with your Heinz beans or your Sainsbury's basics, and you might have to go for the basics, but you'll survive. And then the next month, you up it to 2%. You're just 1% more. Just the same you've already done. You've already cut that much out of your expenditure. Just do it again, and it'll be fine. If you do that every month for 10 months, you'll be giving 10%. And I think that you can see that happen. Because here's the third and final question. How can I make these match up? What is it that you need to do to take the ideal amount that you want to give to the church and the amount that you can give now and make them meet? Because I think that's a responsibility that we've got. We need to be asking these questions when we're spending money. And for some of you, it's just small things. It's cutting out small things. It's just spending a little bit less on a night out. It's, you know, not eating out quite as often. It's next time your phone contract is due for renewal, rather than getting a new phone and a new contract, you just go onto a SIM-only plan and keep that phone for another year or two. For some of you, it might be actually next time that you're looking at moving, you have to consider moving to somewhere that isn't quite as spacious. It's a little bit smaller, but that's the way that you're going to start living a 90%, 10% lifestyle, whatever it may be. These are the decisions that we are going to have to make. Now, we'll see that on your chairs, you've got a little card that looks like this. We used these a few months ago when we announced the launch of our new service that we're starting in January, and we asked people to make pledges of giving to the church. And I want you to take one of these, and you don't necessarily have to fill it in like this. We're not going to collect them in this time, but what you might want to do, and what I'd quite like you to do, is to write those three questions on the back of it. If we can get those three questions back up, that'd be great. What percentage would I like to give? What percentage can I give now? And how can I make these match up? And some of you need to think about this tonight. You just know you're that kind of person. If you don't think about it tonight, you won't think about it until we next talk about it in church in 6 months' time or whatever. You'll never actually get on with it. Others, you need a bit more time to think about this. You need to go away and pray. You need to go away and kind of read some other bits of the Bible yourself just to work out if what I've said is true, if you agree with me. And that's a good thing to do, but you need these questions so that you can make these decisions. So I want you to take this away, and I want everyone to take one of these away. There's some people here who, you know, you still think, having listened to this, you still think that you're the exception, that this isn't your responsibility at the moment, that your circumstances exempt you from this. And you know what? That's fine. Some of you will think that, and that is okay. Some of you will think that you don't need to do this right now. And, you know, you're still welcome here. You're still part of this family. We still love you. We're not going to send Alexi around to your house with a baseball bat. And, you know, it's fine. We're not going to be chasing you up. This is a personal thing, like we've said. But if you're ready now to surrender some of your finances to God, we should do it now. We should do it tonight. You should start with your next paycheck. And for some of you, 10% just sounds too much. It just sounds too much. But you know what's larger than 10%? 90% is 9 times larger than 10%. And we heard from the story that Jesus told that you are a money manager for God. Imagine if I phoned you up this week and I said, hey, I have just come into a major inheritance and I need someone to manage my money for me. Now, I'm going to transfer it all to you. I'm going to send you all this money that that I've got, and I want you to look after it for me. Here's the terms of this agreement. You get to keep 90% of it. You just need to give 10% of it back to me when I ask for it. That would sound like a pretty good deal. Like, you know, you can trust me. You know you can trust me. So you take the deal. You'd be like, that is 90% of this inheritance for me. I get to do whatever I want to it. No strings attached. You just got to give 10% back. And when you think of it that way, it doesn't sound quite so bad when you recognize the position that you're in. And so here's our big idea for tonight. And then we're going to spend some more time in worship. So why don't the band come up and get ready. The big idea is you are writing a story with God's money. He's entrusted it to you, so write the right story. Don't let this get away from you. Don't delay this. Don't let yourself think, oh, I'll do that when I've got a different job or when I've got a job. You're writing a story at the moment, so start writing it right now. Now, I want to pray. I want to pray that, Jesus, your peace would fill this room. As we've talked about this emotive subject that causes stress and anxiety for so many people, I pray that your peace and your comfort and your freedom would fall in this place, that people would not feel any pressure, that no one would feel any guilt, because you don't bring guilt on people, that people would be able to consider this as a joy, a privilege to be managing your money and to give. I've just got a sense that maybe there's someone here, and in your family, particularly with your parents, money has been an inflammatory sort of subject. And I don't know, maybe you live with them now, maybe you don't, but it still affects you. When you think about money, when you think about how you're going to spend your money, you have this stress that you'd need to be accountable to your parents, that you need to justify the way that you use your money, and that's just a weight that is hanging over you. I think Jesus wants to release you from that. He wants to bring freedom. So we're going to have people over there on our prayer sofas. If that's you, if that resonates, then maybe go and pray with them. For the rest of us, God, I pray that you would give us wisdom in applying these principles to our own situations, and that you give us the grace to start giving to your mission, that we would change our stories, we'd be able to change the story of our friends and our family, we'd be able to change the story of this city, of this nation, that we'd see a move of your spirit that we're writing ourselves into the story of, writing into the history books. Amen.